Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For many Americans, lived history began with World War II. For others, Vietnam and civil rights marches. But for Americans aged 18 to 29, the so-called millennials, America is 9/11, Katrina, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Great Recession, and Barack Obama. That's their time, their launch pad into a new century. How's the view? How do they see the way ahead in the century that will be theirs? This hour on Point, we're talking with millennials about how they see this country's present and future. You can join the conversation. Is this you? 18 to 29 and navigating the deepest economic crisis since the Great Depression, how do you see the way ahead? And for all, what's the challenge being handed to this generation? What's your advice? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour are Joshua Sargent, Charles Mitchell, and Marcela Garcia Castañon. They are all officially millennials. Josh is with me here in the studio. He's 22, from Portland, Oregon, now a senior at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. He's studying international relations. Josh, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Marcela joins us from Seattle, originally from Arizona, 25 years old, a graduate student now at the University of Washington. Marcela, thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, Tom. Hi there.
And Charles joins us from Washington, where he works at a nonprofit focused on education, 27 years old, and we've had the pleasure of his company for some years now. Charles Mitchell in Washington, thank you for joining us.
Tom, good to be back with you.
It's great to have you. Let's see, when we first talked with you, I don't know, it must have been 5 or 6 years ago, you were still in college. You're out, Charles.
I did escape.
Out there in the cruel world.
Well, that's right. I find it's not all that cruel and cool, but it is good to be out, and it's good to be back with you.
It's great to have you with us. I'll let everybody know just as soon as Marcel is here, but help us dive in. You guys have come of age in some pretty wild time here. Everybody's looking out in the future right now. You've seen all these poll results lately about the millennials are this and the millennials are that. I just wanted to start by asking whether you individually feel yourselves as kind of different from generations that came before. Just Sergeant, let me put it to you. When you look around, look at your peers, look at your, Gen Xers or your parents, do you feel like a different crew coming into its own?
I do. And I think that there are two very specific ways that I would identify us. One is 9/11 and just the fact that that was our childhood, really. That was kind of
welcome to the world.
The loss of innocence moment. And the second is that Ronald Reagan, to us, is an abstraction. He's not really a political figure. He's not someone we grew up with or anything like that. And I think everyone before us experienced Ronald Reagan.
But an abstraction to you in the same way that George Washington or Abraham Lincoln might be abstraction to,
yes,
to your
same,
elders.
Exact same way.
Yeah. And 9/11 as childhood, do you remember how old you were on that September 11th?
I was 13 and in sixth grade.
So what did you take from it? Is the world a dangerous, hellish, scary place? Or do you just absorb it and have sort of a bigger tolerance for the very rough stuff?
I think, especially coming from the West Coast, it was more you just absorb it because I didn't know anyone.
You were in Portland, Oregon. It was a long way.
It was a very long way.
Charles, how about you? Do you see 9/11 as the foundational experience in life or not?
You know, it's interesting you asked, Tom, because on 9/11, I was a freshman in college, mm-hmm. and as you know from the past, I went to Bucknell University in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. where a huge, huge percentage of the student body is from New York and New Jersey.
Right.
So it was not at all abstract for us. I was in a geology lab that morning for 4 hours, and by the time I got out, it was all, the buildings were destroyed. And everyone else was watching television. I just blindly walked into that. Hey, what are y'all watching?
Mm-hmm. And there
saw them destroyed and heard from people who said, I don't know where my mom is. I don't know where my dad is.
Everybody's reacted to that in different ways. For your generation, it was formative. It's right in the middle of your youth. Young millennials voted 2-1 for Barack Obama, but you came of age, Charles, as a conservative. Do you feel that 9/11 had something to do with that in your case or different origins?
I do. I do, and I was on campus in the era of the launching of the wars in which we are still enmeshed, and I think that for me and for many I was with, there was a feeling of our country is under attack, we have to defend it. That was channeled in a variety of ways. For me, it was having rallies to support the troops and things like that. I don't think that's the only way to channel that energy, but certainly for me, yes, that was and remains part and parcel of my attitude towards politics and all those things.
Marcela Garcia Castañón in Seattle, you're a child of immigrant parents. They worked in a migrant agricultural work, and now you've got kind of a liberal view of the world. Do you see your generation as leaning that way? Is it clear yet what the politics of the millennials are going to be, to your mind, Marcela?
I think we certainly have a different future from where my parents came from, certainly. And it's difficult to pinpoint where we're headed unless we know exactly where we come from. And so I'm not entirely sure if all youth in America will be leaning liberal, but I certainly see that the election of Barack Obama and recent events have certainly pushed towards a more liberal understanding of our future in the world.
So we're going to get some survey data in a few minutes looking at your generation, but I'm just interested how you see it yourselves. I mean, Josh, I think a lot of older people are feeling some guilt because, you know, here's this load of woe being handed to your generation. We've got the debt. We've got an economy we're not sure. Education system maybe not working right. Wars we're still in the middle of. When you talk with your college classmates, you're the youngest on our panel at 22, Do they articulate this? Do they say, my God, look what we've been handed? Or is it like, okay, let's go, we'll fix it, off we go?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty, especially because of the economy. People right now are more focused on, as college seniors, which is my class, getting a job, which is an incredibly stressful prospect right now.
Incredibly. I mean, very, very difficult.
And so I would say that right now we're not even looking at, say, the national debt or those bigger issues, because you're so focused on micro issues of, I need a job, I need a place to live next year, my parents don't want me back.
Right. What am I going to do? Marcela, how about you? Do you feel a sense of optimism in your peers about the future, despite all the stuff around us now, or feel like you're being handed kind of a raw deal?
Well, I have to agree with Joshua. There's certainly a lot of uncertainty. I mean, I'm a graduate student, and talking to graduate students my age and older, it's the sense of a lot of them came back to school because they couldn't find a job. A lot of them aren't sure if the economy is going to get any better by the time they do go out on the market. So it's just a general sense of we hope that the future is better, but the way things are looking, it's difficult to have that level of optimism.
Charles, what do you feel around you in your peer group, if you can speak to that? Determination, resentment for you know, the hand that's been dealt, something else?
Well, obviously I'm in a little bit different of a peer group, and I have to say, especially in Washington, I feel in a certain sense as if we're in a bubble, because Washington is, quite frankly, the best place to live right now if you want a job, because there's a lot of government and government-connected jobs here. But I think there's another bubble that's worth talking about here, Tom, and it occurred to me while Josh was talking, you know, pointing out that in his senior year, everyone is focused on a job and all that. And that was my experience in college, too. And I think that my fear, I should say, is that there is a somewhat unique or more pronounced feature of our generation there. I think that we are more so than other generations a me-focused, inward-focused generation. I don't mean to say that other generations were perfect or any of those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But if you look at how this generation spends its time, if you look at, you know, I believe it's 18 to, I know this is a little bit out of the period, but 15 to 24-year-olds spend 8 minutes reading a book a day. But, you know, much more time on Facebook, learning about what they and their friends are doing and that sort of thing. I fear that we are looking too much at things like that, that we are too focused on ourselves and maybe those immediately around us, and that we're not grappling in an intelligent way with these large issues that, as you point out, do face our country.
Well, I wonder because, I mean, the boomers were called the me generation by the, editors, headline writers who preceded them. Now, Josh, people look at that time that your generation spends on Facebook and everything else, And I mean, some would say that's the opposite of me. That's the socially networked generation. Which is it?
I would say that to say that it's completely me-focused would be wrong, just because everyone's time spent on a social networking site is focused on everyone else, not themselves. Nobody spends a whole bunch of time looking at their own pictures or their own profile. They spend it looking at someone else, whether it's a friend's or potential romantic interests or anything, but it's never focused on the personal.
Marcella, do you think that kind of networked generation means ultimately more political engagement, more political awareness, or not?
Certainly. I actually think that Facebook is probably the best way to mobilize. I mean, all of the campaigns in the 2008 election had Facebook pages, and they had a lot of followers, they had a lot of people, and they used Facebook and Twitter to mobilize those individuals out to rallies, to campaigns, events, and that's different from previous generations. So it's not necessarily me-focused in the sense of, you know, you post the most mundane comments on Twitter, but it certainly builds that sort of network that you need to move people out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with young Americans, millennials, ages 18 to 29 qualifies that kind of generation, bracketed right there, talking with them about how they see the country's present and future. Joshua Sargent is with us, a Portland, Oregon guy, 22 years old, now at Brown University. Charles Mitchell, out of Bucknell, he's now in Washington, 27 years old, with a kind of conservative view of the world. Marcella Garcia Castañon, 25, graduate student at the University of Washington, originally from Arizona, maybe a little more liberal-leaning, and we'll talk about where Josh comes down. We're also joined today by John Della Volpe. He's director of polling at the Institute of Politics at Harvard University, directed a recent study of millennials and their political views and prospects for the future. John, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what are the headlines? What do you see in the big survey data about what's going on with the millennials?
There are a couple of big headlines, the first of which is that there's a solid majority of young adults or millennials in this country who are deeply concerned about their personal economic status today.
Like really literally today.
Like about meeting bills and obligations today, mm-hmm. Rent, apartment, books, tuition, et cetera.
But that's always the case with young people, right?
It's been the case for quite some time, but we've never seen this level of concern and this much anxiety among this generation.
You find 45% who don't know if they're going to be able to continue to pay their tuition.
Absolutely right.
That sounds very high.
It does. It does. And it was regarding a conversation, a focus group we had in Columbus, Ohio, about a year ago when we were speaking with a young millennial who talked about that concern. His mother was a teacher. His father had been laid off. And he was concerned about just surviving the semester at Ohio State.
There was a big Pew report on this generation. The headlines came out, you know, this is the hopeful generation, the optimistic generation. Less than a third of those with jobs earn enough to lead a kind of life they want now, but 88% Pew found are confident that they will one day. Do you see a generation of hopeful young Americans here or not?
They are hopeful, and they, since the very beginning of their education, they tried to take matters into their own hands. Although they are less secure today economically, they're less secure, I think, about the world, they have always been very, very much engaged in helping themselves and helping other people within their communities.
Politically, where did your survey of 3,000-plus 18 to 29-year-olds find them coming down?
Well, today, there are certainly kind of more independents than we've seen even in the prior survey from last November, though we have more Democrats and Republicans. What we have found, which was slightly surprising based on the level of engagement we saw among Democrats in 2008, it's actually the young Republicans in this country who are more fired up and ready to engage in the midterm elections than Democrats.
Do you have a percentages on those?
About 41% of the young Republicans, 18 to 29-year-olds, say they will definitely be voting in the midterm elections. 35% of young Democrats. Small number, but still statistically significant at this point.
And what about independents? Do they show up in the readiness to act column?
Not as much, especially during a midterm election, Tom.
So does this look like a swing vote in the midterms to you? Does this look like an engaged generation right now, or just the right end of the spectrum?
Well, certainly in the 2008 presidential, approximately 1 in 5 of all votes were among millennials, 18 to 29-year-olds. There were actually more votes cast among people under 30 than over 65 for the second election in a row. I don't expect that to be the same impact in the midterm elections, but there certainly will be a swing vote in many districts. Whether we have more Republicans than would be expected or whether or not the young Democrats can engage and mobilize like they did in 2008 will tell the tale for many congressional seats.
Josh Sargent, you are maybe our independent in this crew. So you're looking out at both people among your peers. I mean, both crowds. Who do you see with the energy out there in terms of politics? Are your peers leaning left, you know, right, Republican, Democrat, or somewhere else?
I think that the more conservative people I know are much more energized for this election. I feel like most of the liberals I know voted for Obama, expected some radical change when he was elected, and instead they got, well, they got the continuation of the war, they got an economic crisis that doesn't really seem to be fixing itself, and they feel very apathetic about politics right now. They feel disconnected. They feel like they didn't get what they were told they were going to get, almost as if they were misled, while the young Republicans feel like this is what we told you you were going to get, and now we want our chance.
Marcella, I think you've got – I think you've said you may be more liberal than the president, or at least the presidency is the way it's unfolding. Where do you see the energy among your peers in terms of political focus?
Well, I think everybody saw in Obama what they wanted to see in Obama. And, I mean, I study politics for a living, so it's difficult for me to remove that a little bit. And I just see that in terms of the youth energy, I certainly don't – I wouldn't discount Democratic youth, and I certainly wouldn't say that they're going to be any less energized than they were in 2008. I just think that there is – because they now have a concrete example of what they got in a president, I think there's a different approach that needs to be taken in order for them to get mobilized the same way – in the same numbers that they got mobilized in 2008.
How do you feel about the Obama presidency so far as a pretty ardent supporter at one time? Are you still? What do you think of the way it's unfolded, Marcella?
I certainly don't blame the president for the problems that have emerged. I think it's been a difficult year for him. He's basically had to go up against a party of no, to quote some of the more liberal media of in the Republicans, in the sense that he's trying, and he certainly had this he attempted bipartisanship and didn't get anywhere with it. And I respect the fact that he attempted it, and I actually hold Republicans accountable for the problems that have occurred since.
Charles Mitchell, where do you see your generation's politics evolving? I mean, you came up conservative, first real big election out of the gate. It's Barack Obama that your peers in age helped put in office. Where do you see things going, Charles?
Well, Tom, I actually think the most interesting issue as we think about this is not which way this generation is going to vote in 2010 or which way it voted in 2008, because, frankly, I don't think anybody knows, and generations don't vote in a unitary way to begin with. But I do think it's interesting to look at what we upon what basis we're voting, and that's where I have a concern, and frankly I think it underlies the swinging nature that we're seeing of this vote. First very much for Obama, and now there's excitement in the more conservative camp. I think the evidence is unmistakable, going back to what we were talking about before the break, that this generation, including me, we're poorly educated, and we do not have, many of us, most of us, a good basis upon which to evaluate the pressing, important issues facing our country. You know, study after study, for instance, has shown, you know, a quarter of us can identify a passage from the Gettysburg Address. You know that the statistics on understanding economics or even being able to figure out how much gas we have to get to the next gas station. I mean, I don't intend to idealize previous generations, and education has always been an issue, but we're just not prepared. We just are fundamentally not prepared, and I think that remedying that is critically more important than, frankly, me worrying about whether, quote-unquote, my side is going to come out on top or not.
But it's a little late for remedying what might have been civics classes in elementary school, but Is that fundamentally a problem, Charles? You don't have to go back that many generations to find those where an awful lot of Americans didn't go beyond junior high school, my own grandfather.
That's true, Tom, but I don't think the issue, frankly, is educational attainment. I think it's what you get while you're in. And I would posit, for instance, my grandfather was high school educated only. Mm-hmm. My grandfather got a better education in high school in South Philadelphia than I got at Bucknell University. I'm sorry. I love my alma mater, but that's just the way it is.
Wow. Josh, you are independent here. Why? What puts you sort of swinging in the middle, as Charles might have put it?
The fact that I had to grow up with a father who started his own business, ran his own business, and built it into a very successful, at this point, real estate business, meant that I could not support fiscal liberalism. I always grew up where money matters and it's very important to control what you spend and how you spend it.
Right.
But I also grew up in Portland, Oregon with gay friends in high school who were openly gay, and you can't be socially conservative in that sense. You can't not support gay marriage.
Right.
When your friends are gay, because what are you going to do? Tell them you can't get married?
Well, and your generation, clearly from the numbers, that's not their first concern, those kind of social issues. But that leaves you in the middle. So what's your critique of, at this point, of the right? What's your critique of the left?
I think that the right has not been offering a solution. They don't like what the left is doing, and they complain about the deficit, and they complain about especially economic issues, but they have not offered a real solution to Social Security or to Medicare other than talking points.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the left has offered a solution of we'll just spend until we fix everything, but they haven't ever explained how they can afford to spend until they can fix everything.
Where do you think your generation is going to end up then? Back in the middle or with the same kind of polarization you might see in your seniors in age?
I really don't know. We're still very focused on forming our political views.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a lot of, especially on the college campuses, knee-jerk liberalism that may dissipate a little bit when they realize how much they have to pay for social welfare programs for the elderly, especially.
That bill could come due with a wallop. Josh, Charles, Marcella, please stand by. And John Della Volpe with me here in the studio. We've got a lot of callers I want to invite in here. Let's go to Montgomery, Alabama. John, you're on the air, John.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see there, John?
Well, I'm 29 years old. I was in the Army for about 8 years. I was a helicopter pilot, medevac pilot. I've been to Iraq twice, and I was also at Hurricane Katrina. And I guess my main point that I want to throw out there is technology changed so rapidly from the 2 15-month deployments I had when I came back and seeing how the Internet changed, seeing how people could access the Internet. I think communication has increased tremendously, via like cell phones when I came back advanced so much. The only problem is our interaction with humans, human contact, face-to-face contact, where you get so much information about someone when you first meet them, is kind of falling away. I think as that continues to happen, people are going to still stay in touch, but the communication is not going to be as quality as it used to be.
John, let us pick up that technology, but let me ask you, your two tours in Iraq, and of course the wars have been huge in your youth, but only 2% I'm seeing in the surveys of this generation have served in the military. That's actually smaller than earlier generations by quite a long shot. What about in your peers in age and their attitude toward military service? How do you feel it, John?
Well, I do know for a fact that the military service itself, every single one of my peers that I served with, and I got to speak for a huge majority of them, every single one joined for a benefit for them, as opposed to a benefit which I guess I was perceived like in the past. I can't be 100% factual in the sense that everybody joined to service the country. It's changed tremendously. And I think Josh was talking about earlier how people have gotten more central and focused on themselves, like in a way, lack of better words, is selfish, which it doesn't make a good prospect for people uniting together and getting through some real difficult times that I do see coming.
John, I appreciate your perspective. We're not going to call you selfish after two tours there, but it's great to get your perspective there. And let us pick up the technology piece. John Della Volpe, what about it? In your survey of the generation, how do you see technology playing out? Is it a uniter, a divider, an atomizer? I don't know.
The way in which we've seen technology play is that it's connected young people with other young people, not just in their communities, but also around the world, which is completely different, Tom, than when you and I were in college.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual at all for young people to have Facebook friends outside of the United States and to be connected with individuals who they might have gone to college with overseas.
Does that make them globalists instead of America firsters or not?
In many ways, in their foreign policy, we have seen they have a much more multilateral view of the world. In fact, a majority of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents believe that the United Nations and other countries ought to take the lead in solving international crises and conflicts.
Not just the U.S. superpower.
Not anymore. Completely different than the Gen X and the Boomer generations before.
Charles Mitchell, what do you think of our vet John in Montgomery and his observations on technology and, you know, its effect on the generation?
Well, first, I want to thank him for his service. And secondly, I think he's absolutely right. And to the, you know, we discussed this for a few minutes earlier. Mm-hmm. And as Marcella pointed out, there are certainly other uses for Facebook than focusing on your navel, such as being involved in campaigns. Nobody questions that.
Mm-hmm.
There are also such uses for the Internet. But if you look at the data and if, frankly, you look at what actually goes on Facebook, the vast majority of it is not substantive engagement with important things. It's who's dating who, who went to which party. I don't mean to say, you know, you shouldn't go to parties. I go to parties.
Right, sure.
That's not the point. But the point is, what are we spending the preponderance of our time dealing with? And I think that, the boomers are the me generation. If you don't look at that, look at what they're doing in Congress right now. But the fact of it is, this technology that's available to us is unprecedented in the history of mankind, and we're not using it in the way that you must use a book, frankly, or that you must use a newspaper. You can't use a newspaper to gossip. You have to read it.
Of course, as Marcella says, it did play a big role in the 08 election. You never get away from the technology question with this generation. FD, Cambridge, Massachusetts. FD, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess the comment, well, first let me say I'm 27,
okay.
So I am a millennial.
Yeah.
But I'm a pretty privileged millennial, it seems like most of the guests on your show. And to me, it's like the elephant in the room here is the class inequality and the wealth gap that's facing our whole society and, of course, millennials specifically. And I'd just like to hear your guests kind of throw that into the mix. Like, how do you deal with the fact that people are in really different places socioeconomically, even in our generation?
We'll pick it up. Marcella, I guess you would not, certainly by youth, fall into a privileged class as the daughter of migrant agricultural workers. But as an issue, you hear FT saying it's the elephant in the room. What do you say?
It's certainly a big old elephant in the room.
Economic inequality.
Yeah. I mean, my parents came to the United States, obviously, and became migrant field workers because they didn't speak the language. But even as I've been here basically my entire life, my mom is now a teacher, and she has to deal with a lot of these issues of getting her students even just properly fed. And that's certainly part of the future way we should look at millennials and future generations of America.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with young Americans, millennials aged 18 to 29, about how they see the country's present and future. You can join the conversation with Josh Sargent, 22 years old, with me in the studio out of Portland, Oregon, now at Brown University. Charles Mitchell, 27, in Washington, working in a nonprofit focused on education there. Marcella Garcia Castañon joins us from Seattle, originally from Arizona, daughter of immigrants. She's a grad student at the University of Arizona, of Washington. And John Della Volpe is with me in the studio, director of polling, the Institute of Politics at Harvard University. John, check in with us again here on what you're hearing in this conversation and how it may be reflected in the survey work that you've been doing lately.
I think you did a terrific job, because I think these three individuals really do reflect the millennials that we've been tracking in our surveys for now 10 years now at the Institute of Politics. We talk about kind of their concern for the country today, but again, we find that they continue to be engaged, whether it's in international affairs or whether it's in their local communities in Washington, D.C., and other places. This is a generation that grew up with public service being kind of central to who they were, and community service who they were.
More than previous generations?
We've seen we weren't able to track a number of these characteristics in previous generations, but I believe that their commitment to community service is something that we haven't seen perhaps since the greatest generation.
Is it translating into politics, into political engagement, or not?
It's translating currently into community service. 6 in 10 college students for the last decade have been involved in community service. And in 2004, 2006, and 2008, it did translate into political engagement with increasingly high numbers of young people engaging in politics and campaigns, donating as well as voting.
We've got a lot of callers here, but also on the web. A web comment here from Anna, 25 years old, and she says, I think more and more of my age group is coming to the conclusion that our lifestyle in this country, I guess, is unsustainable, and there's a mistrust of the media and advertisers insofar as how we're influenced on the decision, maybe in thinking about that. Here's another from Pierre, who says, I think there's a combination of dogged, grounded optimism in the face of current reality. It's a mark of our millennial generation. Marcella, what about lifestyle and the future? You know, lots of people are interested whether your generation thinks it will have the American dream that has traditionally kind of meant a standard of living. More than that, but very importantly that. What do you see in expectations of your peers, Marcella, on that front?
I think there's certainly been a move away from this lifestyle of excess, of having big homes and big cars and fancy clothes and flashy electronics, and we're in a lot of ways buckling down with the economic downturn. We're recognizing that, you know, we thought we would come out of college with the ability to get a job and have all these fancy things, and that's not turning out to be as true as we expected. And so there's certainly a backlash towards that excess that has been dominating for the last decade or so.
I've seen you saying that you think we're on the upswing as a country. So if it's not in economic terms necessarily, what do you mean by that? Upswing in what way, Marcella?
I think one of the greatest things about America is that we have a great optimism about where we can go. We've been to such great places in our own history that we can only get better. And I think that's reflected in the way young people communicate, especially with Dr. Della Volpe was commenting about community service is that in a lot of senses we do give back, I feel like, more than previous generations. We recognize that there's a community that we have to build and that we have to contribute to that community in order for it to go forward.
Josh, what do you see in terms of economic expectations? Fear, disillusionment, or confidence that it'll work out somehow, or maybe changed expectations?
Personally, I know that there's very little chance I'm going to out-earn my parents. And I think that there are, especially among the class at Brown, there are a lot of people, especially among the who come from wealthier families, where they probably aren't going to out-earn their parents.
How do they feel about that? Is it just?
And I think that there actually is some acceptance of the fact that it's okay. I think that there earlier generations, there may have been a feeling that you had to out-earn your parents. You weren't an adult if you didn't make more money than they did. But I think, at least for me personally, it's okay that I may not earn as much money as my father did over the course of his lifespan, as long as I have a lifestyle that I'm happy with.
So does that mean you may have a different yardstick about what success means? Does that mean it'll still be economic or a different measure?
I think that people are less focused on a purely economic yardstick of success, and they're more focused on a happiness. Am I satisfied with what I'm doing, both in my job and my personal life? Do I have a good work-life balance? And if I'm earning slightly less money, that's not the most important thing in the world. That's not the only yardstick for success.
Charles, Marcella identifies as liberal, and she sees the country as on an upswing. What about it, my dear old conservative friend? Are you more curmudgeonly, or do you see an upswing out there?
Well, I know I sound like a curmudgeon. It's partially because I am, and the conflicts or the comments on your website reflect that. But one of the reasons, Tom, that I'm so hepped up about people knowing the history of this country mm-hmm. is that it is a history of overcoming obstacles, and I agree most emphatically with Marcella. And some of the people that irritate me the most, quite frankly, are conservatives who don't know history and think, oh my gosh, how can we come out of this? I mean, hello, have mm-hmm. you read about the Great Depression? Have you
right.
read about the founding?
Right.
Do you understand that this is what this country does? My fear is we don't know that story. I also want to speak for a second to what Josh said. I live in Washington where everything's expensive, and I work at a nonprofit, so I think you know where I'm coming from on this sort of standard of living issue.
Mm-hmm.
But the quibble that I would have is not that our generation is seeking service and that sort of thing, which I think we are, sometimes without the information we need to do it. But my fear is that happiness cannot be the standard for a lifestyle. Yeah, I understand money should not be the standard either, but honestly, you know, the most important thing to me, I don't think, should be whether I'm happy. It should be whether I'm doing what's right for my wife and for the kids that we hope to have. It's service, especially not just to strangers, but to those in our family. And that's, I think, a value we can see in the World War II generation
mm-hmm.
that I think we have an inner yearning for that in this generation. I hope that it turns, again, from ourselves to serving others and not just strangers.
John Della Volpe, this is something you found in your survey. This is what harkens back to the World War II generation, in a sense.
Absolutely. And at a time, again, of deep economic anxiety, when we ask young people the kinds of attributes they'd be looking for in their first job, we had just as many people say mentorship, the opportunity to learn from colleagues and make an impact immediately, than they did about compensation. So I think it does harken back to what both Charles and Josh have said.
But Charles, the pursuit of happiness also goes pretty far back as an American goal, like right back to the beginning. Do people really give that up or redefine it? Or is this the buckle down and, you know, eat bitter fruit century?
No, Tom, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in the way that you define happiness. And the way that I hear it said too often is, I am happy. So I, all about me, me, me,
mm-hmm.
me. Yes, the pursuit of happiness is a value. It's much older than this country, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, you know, we see, for instance, in marriages very often the standard is, well, whether I feel good. Well, I think that the happiness should be held to a different standard, and one of the ways we should be happy is in serving our spouses and giving them things that we might want for ourselves or all those
mm-hmm.
sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that value is realized in our generation.
That sounds like a strong perspective, not so open to being buffeted. Pete in Hartford, Connecticut. Pete, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, like the last guy was just talking about a lot is basically how I feel. I'm a 29-year-old. I have one child, another on the way, married. And I feel that a lot of the disconnect with our generation is politics and with history is they don't understand where we came from and what has got us here as a country. And I think a lot politics-wise, our politicians are disconnected with our generation. They think that we're at a different mindset, you know, that we still think the old way. But we're a newer generation who realizes that it's going to take hard work to get back from where we are right now to another good place. And being content with where we are right now and having to maybe pay a little more or, you know, buy a little less and go without is just going to have to be the way it is for a while.
Pete, do you resent that or do you embrace it as just what may be required?
No, I really embrace it as what we really have to do. I mean, I think we're kind of a selfish generation where we feel like in my younger years, I had anything I wanted if I had it, you know what I mean, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And now we really have to work hard for it if we're going to get it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with that, you know, because I'm at an age where I realize that hard work's hard work and you have to do it, you know? And I think a lot of the younger kids don't realize that. And basically, that's about it.
Got it. Pete, good luck with your baby on the way, and thanks for your call. Brian in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd say that my concern for my generation has to do with what seems to be our diminishing attention span. And I think the difference for us is that now we have technology that really facilitates flitting from thing to thing and task to task. And so it's very easy to not do the types of things that required sustained attention, like somebody mentioned earlier, reading a book, which we do less than 8 minutes a day. And the reason this really troubles me is I think the problems that we're facing are so complex that it really pays to be able to devote some sustained attention to things and not just read a blog and then think you have a grasp of the healthcare bill, or, you know, read one New York Times article and think that you understand the history of the First Amendment or something like that. And so I would like to see people in my generation talking a little bit more about putting down our cell phones and our iPhones and putting away the laptop and reading a book, forming book clubs, things like that.
Brian, that's really interesting. Let us pick it up. I mean, Josh, I'm trying to see how this would work. You know, in the midst of busy lives, when technology dominates on so many fronts and your generation is so wired in and checking on, you know, all of its various feeds, is it really going to set all that down and go en masse off to libraries and read the Federalist Papers? And, I mean, surely it can somehow get what it needs online or not?
Well, I think that certainly books are integral to education, and if you haven't read books, especially central books like the Federalist Papers or the Declaration of Independence, it is hard to have or the Constitution. It's hard to have an understanding of what America stands for. And I think that the other part of technology that hasn't been discussed yet is that it can be incredibly destructive for people who can't handle it. I have friends, and I think everyone in my generation has friends mm-hmm. who were overwhelmed by technology, who kind of shut down the rest of their lives and devoted it to technology, whether it was instant messaging or gaming.
Their thumbs always at work on the keypad.
And they may have dropped out of high school. They may have failed out of college. I think it can be a profoundly destructive facet of our lives, especially for people who have addictive personalities.
Marcella, do you see any contradiction between technology and your generation kind of taking on board, embracing, re-embracing original principles in this country? You know, are those in contradiction? Sort of being well-educated citizens with principles guiding their politics and lives? Is that in contradiction with the tech era we're in, or can they somehow support one another?
I actually think they complement each other in the sense that, yes, you can flip between one blog and another, but you're still reading, you're still focusing your attention on a particular issue. And in fact, I actually think that the reason technology complements it so well is that you end up being able to acquire far more information and bring in different perspectives on a certain topic and then weigh those issues yourself and make your own decisions about how you feel about healthcare reform or how you feel about different issues that are being covered in the media, but not necessarily covered at a level that would enable that type of intellectual engagement.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a registered nurse, and I was just calling in to say I've heard a lot of people say they're going to go back to school for nursing or something to do in medical professions. And I graduated in May, and it took me maybe 2 months to find a job, and then the one I found wasn't the one I wanted. And I've heard of places having 10 positions open and getting 600 applicants from qualified nurses. And I don't know where the people are getting the information that there's so much opportunity in the medical field, because I haven't seen it.
So do you worry about the economic future? I mean, you found a job. Good for you on that front. But it still looks uncertain to you, I guess.
Yeah. Like, I've been trying to save money to buy a house for, like, the last 6 months. And it is so difficult because everything's so expensive, especially just on my income. And you add on top of that the school loans that I have to pay back for the 4 years I went. It's just ridiculous.
Steve, we've got it. Charles, what are you feeling here? A kind of generational optimism that will prevail? Or, I mean, your millennial crowd is up against some pretty big challenges here. Could be daunting.
Well, they are daunting. And as I say, I think we have to be conscious that this is not the first time. I think all of us as humans have this sort of inclination to think, man, I'm the first guy who's ever tackled this. Well, you're generally not. But I do think there are a couple unique things. The technology is one of them. I would also say, frankly, as somebody who works on higher education every day, that the amount of debt that this generation is in from college is is staggering, and I think in many cases unprecedented. I also think of the finding in the Harvard study that I think 45% don't know if they can pay for their tuition. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a reason for that. The reason is it is out of control, and it's been going up and up and up. And I look at the loads that people are coming out with, and I look at the salaries that are available in this economy, and I think there's a fundamental disjunction, and something's got to give.
Marcella, where do you see the politics going? John Delavolpe's study found more intensity right now among Republican millennials. Where do you see that headed?
Well, I think it's I hope that there is going to be room for discussion. I hope there's going to be room between conservatives and liberals to have some common ground in the future, and you know, learning the lessons of the past 10 years in the administration, or in the administrations that have been in power.
Josh, you're independent. You're going to stay in the middle, you think? Is that a lifelong posture?
I think it is a lifelong posture. I don't really think I'm going to swing back either way.
Well, there may be a new block emerging right there. Josh Sargent, thanks very much for being with us this hour. It's been great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Charles Mitchell in Washington. Charles, welcome back, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. You guys are great.
And Marcella Garcia-Castagnon in Seattle. Marcella, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It was a pleasure.
John Delavolpe, thanks for your insights on the millennial generation.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.